Episode 2, Resilience. From Vertigo, this is Inside. I'm Damien Roos, and a quick heads up today that there is some language that's not appropriate for younger ears. So if you're listening with kids, it might be better to wait until later. Today, I've got a story for you, and this story begins with a spectacular failure. Now, there's many ways to fail in cycling, but this is about a cyclist who gave it everything and came up short. His name, Cadel Evans, and it was the final climb of Stage 9 of the 2010 Tour de France in the alpine village of Saint-Jean-de-Maurienne.
Forwards by Armstrong, but further down the slopes, the man who started the day in the yellow jersey, Cadel Evans, is having the worst day of his tour so far.
The Australian cyclist cracked on the last big climb of the day and suffered for the final 10 kilometres of the 204.5-kilometre stage.
Kilometre of the race.
Cadel Evans is going to come home now. If he's going to fight, I would say he's probably fighting for third place. Just over 8 minutes as he comes in.
Yeah, I was going to say, Phil, that I think the way he's ridden up to the line here just goes to show that he's still got a lot of guts in there. He wants to stay in this bike race. He pushed himself right the way down to the finish just to make sure he limited his losses as much as possible. A little bit emotional there for Cadel Evans alongside one of his teammates. They did whatever they could. They pushed hard. They tried to stay in contact. But Cadel just could not follow the riders on the acceleration up towards the top of that climb. He just did not have one of those days. He had the sort of day that you don't really ever want.
After finishing the stage, he embraced his BMC teammate, Mauro Santambrogio, who dragged him up the final climb, and in an uncharacteristically rare show of emotion, he broke down in front of the media. This was about more than losing a single stage of the Tour de France. Cadel's dream to win the Tour de France was also gone. This was devastating for Cadel, and if you were a pro cycling fan back then, you'd know about the near misses in the 2007 and 2008 Tour de France, placing second on both occasions by mere seconds. But how did he bounce back? What made him the champion he was when he retired in February 2015 at his own race? In comparison, later on in that same year as Cadel's retirement, in November 2015, another BMC cyclist retired. This time, though, he had only been a professional for 12 months. The rider, Campbell Flakemore. Flakemore was on a steep trajectory ever since this race.
We'll find he's improving that, but look at this. For 2 minutes, the bridge. Campbell Flakemore has got himself a nice carrot now to grab those seconds and chase him down. Our camera's going to concentrate on Flakemore here. As 43.50 is target, is he going to get it? You can see the finish, but can he actually cross in time? And the answer is going to be yes, he can. And the dream games go on for the Australians. A gold in the women this morning and a gold in the men this afternoon.
I read an article by Campbell Flakemore last year, and in this article, he discusses the build-up to those world championships and gives insight into his short time as a pro, where he quit after 1 year in the world tour with the BMC professional cycling team. Curiously enough, Cadel Evans backed him to become a future Australian Grand Tour winner. What happened to Flakemore that ultimately proved Cadel wrong? A few good points were raised in the comments, which are worth discussing here. These comments can be summarised that Flakemore didn't possess a deep-seated desire to be a pro and didn't have the resolve to continue after a crash. The love of cycling and desire to be a professional is not something you can work on. But the second part, the ability to pick yourself up after it gets tough, you get injured, you fail, have to recover, and you have to bounce back. We're going to take a deep dive through the eyes of both of these riders to learn more about resilience. Is it something we're born with, or is it something we can learn? I mean, resilience is an essential element to reach the pinnacle of anything. Author Mats Fitzgerald talks about resilience being the mother of all coping skills.
Resilience is the mother of all coping skills, and really, resilience is just getting back up when you've been knocked down. Of course, you have to do that in order to develop any of the other coping skills, because those other skills require that you be in the game. So if you quit when you're knocked down, if you're not resilient, forget about developing any of these others. So that's your foundation. You have to be resilient because everybody's going to get knocked down.
In other words, resilience is more about just reaching the pinnacle. It's about even being in the game. Mm-hmm. From Vertigo, this is Inside, and today we're talking about resilience, the essential coping skill to reach the pinnacle of your chosen discipline. We'll take a look at what it takes to reach the top, even when you have everything you need. And then we'll take a look at how you can cultivate resilience, no matter what your starting point is. If we're talking about someone with bucket loads of resilience, someone that reached the pinnacle of his sport, we can talk about Cadell. Here he is talking to Jason Bennett about fear on ESPN's Aussies Abroad.
What I notice of, not just in our sport, but a lot of sports, one of the biggest driving factors of really successful individuals is fear. Fear of not winning, or fear of losing, or fear of not being the best they can be or something. And then injuries and crashes and things, but with experience, like a training your strength, training aerobic conditioning, training a skill, it's dealing and confronting these things. It's something you learn with experience.
Cadell is talking directly about the issues you can face as a professional athlete, and I would go so far as to say that his story exemplifies resilience, even when he had everything needed to succeed. Cadell had always been one step ahead of the competition, and my introduction to Cadell was arriving early one morning in the Australian ski resort town of Thredbo. The faint voice of a race announcer calls out the name Cadell Evans, so I quickly turn my head, only to see a blur of colour disappearing in the distance. The year was 1993, and even then, as he sped off to victory in the under-17 national championship race, he had an aura about him. And for good reason. He was that good that he went up to elite senior men's class at national events a year early to push himself harder. This paid off when he raced an elite men's cross-country World Cup in Cairns, Australia, and placed fifth. A feat so remarkable, the podium was extended to five people, a tradition that remains today. Fast forward 20 years later to December 2014, back in Australia on his original training ground outside of Melbourne, riding up one of his favourite hills for the first time since he decided to retire. He had a moment of reflection while talking to another Australian cycling legend, Shane Kelly, about a brief return to his original training grounds before his final months as a professional.
Funny, I went back, it was just a few months ago actually, and it was clear in my head. It was the first time I'd ridden there when I knew I was certain I was going to stop racing. And I went back and I rode up one of my favourite climbs, climb from Hume Vale up to King Lake behind Whittlesea. And it's just one of my favourite climbs. It's peaceful in the forest. I always see some lyrebirds and kangaroos and things. I'm riding up there and I thought, shit. The amount of dreams I had riding up there, thinking what I want to do and become a professional, become a good professional and things. And I was riding up there and it was just a moment of reflection. And rather than looking as an athlete, looking forward to what I'm going to do next, for once I looked back at what I did and thought, all that World Championships, Tour de France and all that.
Not a bad journey.
All done. It's been pretty good, hasn't it?
Cadell fulfilled his dreams. But as you heard at the start of the show, it wasn't an easy road. In order to succeed, he had to rely on his psychological resilience. What's that, you say? Well, to help us understand this more, I enlisted the help of this guy.
David Fletcher.
Dr. David Fletcher focuses on the psychology of performance excellence in sport, business, and other performance domains. His work addresses how high achievers thrive on pressure and deliver sustained success. And he defines psychological resilience at its simplest level as...
For me, it's about an individual withstanding or adapting to pressure. So there's sort of two elements to it. The first one is the withstanding. So it's this idea of, you know, the way I explain it to kids at the simplest level is having this sort of protective force field around you, which can deflect a lot of the pressures that are coming in, so they don't get through and they don't get to you. And then I mentioned the other aspect is adapting to pressure. It's this idea of bending and rebounding back, so this idea of bounce back ability. And so if any of these pressures do get through, they basically don't get through for long, or if they do, they don't throw you off course too much. So that for me is these two sort of elements to resilience and what we're trying to teach when we're teaching resilience in sport context. And it's probably worth just briefly saying what I don't think resilience is. And I don't think it's where you have this breakdown under pressure and under stress. It might be choking, or it might be something a bit more prolonged where things are getting on top of you. And then you have to go through some rehabilitation, some counselling, and you have to get back on track. And That's not to ultimately say that that's actually bad in inverted commas. That might actually help you in the longer term. Most top level athletes have had periods where they've really struggled. And that's probably something we might want to pick up on later on. But yeah, that's how I see resilience in terms of what it is and what it isn't.
These two sides of psychological resilience play a really important role in our understanding of what it takes to protect yourself from failing from pressure. And here's where I want to talk about Campbell Flakemore again. And I do want to recognize something here. It's only because he was so brave in opening up and telling his story that we can even go a bit deeper into the process of his decision to quit his short professional career. So this is not meant as disrespect, but the signs were there even before he signed a professional contract. An interview with Rob Arnold from Ride Media right after his under-23 World Time Trial Championship win and a year before quitting pro cycling, Flakemore talks about his doubts to withstand the pressure of international performance.
Everyone sort of thinks that if you get offered the pro contract, you've got to jump at it. But was there ever a moment where you hesitated and thought, maybe I'll go and become a doctor or something else?
Yeah, there were times this year where, you know, I didn't have many results and for some reason, I just wasn't in good shape from pretty much April through to July. I was sort of just struggling a lot, and yeah, those sort of thoughts are going through my mind a fair bit. I can't compete with these guys, and I'm just suffering. I'm getting beaten, and it's just I'm away from home, and it's too hard, and all those thoughts go through your mind. But it's like anything, really, like. Just takes one or two good things and then you're back. And I was sort of lucky with Lavinia and Worlds, and I think I made the right decision, that's for sure.
Laying this out for everyone to see exposes how fragile confidence and performance can be, especially if there isn't something to fall back on, a solid support network, for example. While it's hard to read into Flakemore's decision and find one main reason why he'd quit, there are a lot of signs when you read through his article that could have been handled in a way to set him up for a higher chance of success. But for me, it raises this question about how much of handling the kind of environments and setbacks experienced in pro sport is innate. I mean, we all respond to pressure in different ways, but what makes top-level performers different? I asked Dr. David Fletcher this, but not after he talked about his own experience as a national-level swimmer, a period in his life that gave him a chance to be surrounded by high-level performers and spark his interest in studying these people.
Taking a look around, it became very clear to me that some people were better at handling things than others. So it wasn't just about technique and it wasn't just about brute strength in the gym. It was also about what went on between people's ears and between training sessions as well. So, yeah, that was a big part for me.
And let's talk about that observation of the other people that you see around. Like, everybody kind of knows those people that just seem to be able to get through these difficult things, these stresses, these moments. How much of it do you think is innate? How much is it in the person before they do any training or have any awareness about what's going on?
Yeah, really good question that. And there's a lot of discussion, debate in the literature, and I've been lucky enough to work with a lot of athletes now down the years. And I think the truth of the answer is that it is a significant proportion is innate, and you don't have a great deal of control over it, i.e. you're born with certain genes which predispose you to handling pressure better. And there's a whole raft of different psychological factors there, elements relating to your personality. Could be things like being an optimistic individual, or it could be darker traits like narcissism and self-absorption and those types of things. There's a whole raft of different personality traits that are influenced by your genes and will enable you to work better under pressure. But that said, that's not the whole part of the story. If it was, then there wouldn't be much need for sports psychologists and to some extent coaches. There are also a lot of techniques that you can use to improve your ability under pressure and stress. And, the evidence for that is, we're not all the same in our mid-20s or in our 30s than we were when we were 11 years old. And that's because we've grown, we've developed, and we've learned different skills and strategies. So it is both, and it's it's just like the physical skills. I mean, if you're tall, you've got an advantage in certain sports like basketball, etc. But being tall on its own is not enough to excel in a lot of sports. You need to put the training in on top of that. And I think psychology is just the same. I don't think there's any particular mystery there. I think if you're going to achieve right at the very top levels, you need to have both the some of the genetic aspects of psychology, but also you've got to put in the mental training and apply it in your training, your physical training day in, day out, and also in competitions too.
So David is basically saying that yes, you can naturally have more resilience, but it's a matter of building on whatever you have. Something Cadell actually mentioned before, that dealing with setbacks is something that is much the same as building on your physical ability, like training your aerobic conditioning or training a skill. It's funny he mentions this other side, because Cadell's physical ability was never really in doubt as he progressed through his career, but his resilience was tested after that 2010 loss. We get an insight into this in his book, The Art of Cycling. You see, when Cadell crossed the line in 42nd place on that stage 9 of the 2010 Tour de France, he yells in his teammate's ear, "I'm sorry, I have a broken arm." His teammate can't believe Cadell was able to keep going. Cadell recalls that day further in his book, where his BMC team manager decides that it's best to speak about his injury publicly, where Cadell tells the press, "I suffer on my bike every day, but I do it with pleasure. The guys on the team have supported and believed in me in this whole project. I am so sorry to have let them all down. My Tour de France is pretty much over. After the stage, I think, well, okay, I can't win the Tour, so I'll just ride to stay in the first 10. After a while, okay, the first 25. I'm in survival mode for the rest of the Tour. I want to finish, considering what I've been through. 24th on the GC by the time we reach Paris is probably pretty good." Until this point in Cadell's career, everything had been building towards a Tour de France victory, and the 2010 results added up to failing to win for the sixth straight year. And to inject myself into the narrative, I, like many of the people around me, and this troubles me to say, had pretty much given hope that Cadell would make the top step of the podium in Paris. How Cadell responds here is where things get really interesting in the world of resilience. I haven't been able to find anything about exactly how devastated Cadell was after the 2010 Tour result, but I believe this result, and indeed all the disappointments that preceded, fed into what might have been the best thing that could have happened to him, because things changed in the lead up to the next year, which I will get into in a moment. But first, David actually supports this idea, this type of loss and failure to motivate yourself.
There is data to suggest that, you know, a couple of failures along the way do act as a sort of springboard to go on and achieve better things. You know, maybe a fourth place at the Olympics, where I say failure in inverted commas, I mean, it's all relative. And it's this idea of it, the athletes that then realise just how lucky they are to be on that stage, how transient an elite level career is, and how temporary it can be. And they can redouble their efforts when they go back to training. They can more forensically examine their training programs and pathways. I remember chatting to a sports scientist who worked closely with Jess Ennis, and she didn't have a failure at the Olympics before London. It was an injury, but a major trauma nonetheless, that prevented her from competing at the 2008 Beijing Games. And he talked about how they sort of redoubled their efforts coming back from that injury, in terms of leaving no stone unturned, in terms of reflecting upon the training program, taking lessons from, you know, training sessions from competitions subsequently. And they felt that sort of gave them a little bit of an edge at world-class level, that then, you know, obviously the rest was history in terms of going on and winning gold medals. So, I don't think it's necessarily all about a childhood adversity. I think there's also major challenges and events that happen along the way as well, which not just negative, I might add, there's also positive ones. You know, if you get a major success at a certain point, then that could be you know, a major motivating factor, particularly at these big decision moments.
So this brings us to the preparation of the 2011 Tour de France, and lots of things changed. Not really a forensic examining of things yet, but changes here and there, spending Christmas in Europe for the first time in 7 years, less intensity in the early season, less training camps, but also having a real team around him. But then there's this setback of a crash in training. And the way he frames this in The Art of Cycling sounds like someone that doesn't get wiped out by a couple of weeks off the bike. He sees it as a chance to give his body a break, and he sees the upside of now being able to focus on other aspects of his preparation, where he reviews his racing and training, tightens up his diet, plus when he's able to ride, which builds from the first day of 30 seconds in the morning and a minute and a half in the afternoon, continuing in this fashion, but enjoying the process and making every pedal stroke count. All of these details are important, and we will come back to them in a moment. But first, the 2011 Tour de France, Cadel's odds of winning stood at 27 to 1. He was 34 years old after all. Only one rider older than he was now had ever won the Tour de France. But even considering this change in Tour favourite status, the one thing he brought to the Tour this time was a calm that was most likely from anger. In Matt Fitzgerald's book, How Bad Do You Want It? Mastering the Psychology of Mind Over Muscle, he talks about anger in this exact situation. Anger is not often thought of as a calming emotion, but this fed-up feeling that transforms failure into resilience is just that. Athletes who have everything it takes to succeed but lack the highest level of resilience are psychologically dependent on things going their way, on not facing too much adversity in competition. This dependency makes them nervous and emotionally reactive. The fed-up athlete, on the other hand, no longer hopes for the uncontrollables to work out of his favour. He is resolved to take total responsibility for his racing, to avenge adversities past and future. This simmering determination gives the athlete a sense of agency and control that is calming. And this describes exactly where Cadel was and what he needed on stage 18. At 60.4 kilometres to go, the most decisive moment of the 2011 Tour de France, and probably in all of Cadel's career, happened.
As he looks across here now, Andy Schleck has lifted the ante, so he's used his last man, Stuart O'Grady. There's a reaction only from Kerimai, I think it is, who has started for Europcar. Now, can Tommy Voigtler answer this one? They're going to have to do something. He's gone very early.
Tommy Voigtler, what about Alberto Contador, and what about Cadel Evans? They've got to respond to this. This is the steepest part.
It's the second last climb of the day, of a hilltop finish, and no one will chase or work with Cadel. When he hits the final climb of the day, he knows that he has to chase. And in The Art of Cycling, we get a glimpse of his anger. At 8Ks to go, the gap is 3 minutes 45 seconds. John comes on the radio and says, Cadel, you're doing great. This is fantastic. Don't worry. It doesn't matter what happens at this Tour de France. You've already proved you're a champion. But as I ride, I'm thinking, fucking hell, if I don't win now, I'm going to be so fucking mad. So I ride and ride.
46 and counting, as now Cadel Evans again turns. He needs every second he can get to try and stay in this race, because the time trial will favour Cadel Evans.
Well, Frank Schleck sitting on his shoulder there. That's psychologically again, though. A minute has gone by. Cadel Evans is the one still trying to save the jersey for himself later on in the Tour de France, but also today for Thomas Voigtler, who has been incredible.
He's got it down to just on 2 minutes. He was 1:18 behind. Now he's a little not that far.
Cadel goes on to beat the Schleck brothers in the penultimate day's 42.5 kilometre time trial and rides the final stage to win the 2011 Tour de France. It's a pretty epic tale, but me and you are not done yet. I want to go behind Cadel's resilience to help you bounce back from setbacks. And David has been working on some practical recommendations.
Got a practical paper out that came out, I think it was a year or two ago now, on mental fortitude training. And that's really where we've tried to talk a lot more about the practical implications of the work that we've done.
You heard him say it, but I'll say it again. David's concept is called mental fortitude training, and it focuses on three main areas: personal qualities, facilitative environment, and challenge mindset to enhance performers' ability to withstand pressure. The big key with mental fortitude training is that although these three areas have been presented separately, in practice, they will need to be addressed and integrated together to maximize their effect. And so I thought we could take a look at David's recommendations for each area, but use Cadel as examples. Number one, focus on personal qualities. Develop the psychological characteristics for excellence. In other words, developing the psychological factors that protect an individual from negative consequences. And while it doesn't explain everything, Cadell thinks this character assessment from Greg Boehm of the Melbourne Age newspaper is spot on. Temperamentally, the Tour suits Cadell. He is a singular combination of diesel engine and violin, able to chug along at metronomic RPMs for hours at a time, but also delicately strung, obsessive about health, hygiene and appearance, a reclusive, sensitive soul who is married to an Italian pianist and cares about his little dog and Tibet, but on the road is steely and indestructible. It really says to me that he had, or has, psychological characteristics for excellence at the start, but also focused on developing them further for this specific event. Number two, the environment, autonomy, supportive climate. He talks a lot about the role people played at each step of his career, naming people and times when they helped him and influenced him. And although it's hard for me to say how different the support environment at BMC was compared to other teams, you can't doubt that it was a very important factor in his approach to the 2010 and 2011 tours that got him through some difficult times. And especially the way he mentions that he won because BMC were riding so well as a team and overcoming setbacks. And number three, mindset. Positively evaluate and interpret the pressure they encounter. I just mentioned it, but it is very clear that Cadell slowly built up his ability to deal with all types of setbacks, mostly from experience. He knew they were a part of the process, and I'm sure there were times when it wasn't easy to deal with them. But his results suggest that he managed to reframe things and get through all major setbacks he experienced over his career. The crash in training in 2011 is a great example of this, and the way he reframes this as a chance to give his body a break, and he sees the upside of now being able to focus on other aspects of his preparation. To wrap up here, I encourage you to seek out more information about mental fortitude training or anything that can help you cultivate resilience, because as we've learned, even if you have every opportunity and are born with amazing resilience innately, much like physical training, there is always something to work on to help you reach the pinnacle of your sport. And this might make the difference between just being in the game and achieving your dreams. Inside is produced by Vertigo and hosted by me, Damien Roos. If you enjoyed the show and you want to hear more, subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen and tell your writing buddies. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you in the next episode or out on the road.